from the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida. It's the Annie Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's June 3rd, 2011, and you're listening to the greatest poker cast the internet ever invented. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long. Wow, you leave us no room to improve there.
I know, and every week, too. I challenge you every week. But you know what? We come through every week, so it's not that hard.
Pretty soon the Martians are going to get ticked at you. Like, come on, you're not even on Mars.
I can't wait for that day when one of those little Voyager things reports back that they found, you know, a deck of bicycle playing cards in a crater on Mars or something.
Well, I got to tell you, buddy, there's a little bombshell in the poker world this week.
Yeah.
You know, we don't get a lot. You know, sometimes people like to make things bigger than they really are. So I try not to throw that word around too much. You know, Black Friday, you know, Money Maker winning the World Series, those are bombshells. This is probably not quite that level.
Right.
But anytime Phil Ivey speaks, he's like the E.F. Hutton of the poker world, isn't he?
Yes.
Like, you never hear from the guy. And you heard from him this week. For the listeners that haven't heard, he issued a press release, which right there, that is a bombshell in itself.
Yeah.
The fact that he's the most media-shy poker star out there, I would think, right?
Yep.
Rarely does interviews, if ever. And you never see him do any kind of promotion other than what he was contractually obligated to do with Full Tilt. You just never hear from him, and it's part of his allure, right?
Yep.
So he issued a press release, so that alone would have been big. But what the release was were two more big bombshells.
Just
first, he's suing Tiltware, which is the parent company of Full Tilt, over their sluggishness in paying out players. And if that wasn't big enough, boom, he's going to sit out the World Series this year, in essence of a sign of solidarity for all the Full Tilt players whose money's tied up and can't afford to buy in like he can.
Man, I really just don't know what to make of this. I have to be honest. Now he's one of the primary owners of the company, right? I mean, isn't he one of the top three or four guys that started the site? And
yeah, that I don't know for sure. Maybe he was just he had some kind of stake in it or something. I don't know. I would think that if he really was that high up, he would be able to facilitate some change without having to resort to a lawsuit. But I don't know.
Oh, and the other thing, too, is Tiltware is, you know, the company that has the software, but maybe Full Tilt is a different company. He owns some of Full Tilt and Tiltware. I don't know. But and just the fact that, I mean, everyone, it's kind of like Tiger Woods, and I hate to compare him to that because they always say he's a Tiger Woods booger. Yeah. But what I mean is everyone's watching to see what Tiger Woods, if he's going to break Nicklaus's record. You know, I mean, that's what they're watching now. And obviously he's been having a slump, so he's been set back a little bit. But all I know is every year I look forward to seeing how many bracelets this guy is going to win and if he's going to ever, you know, catch Chan and Helmuth and Brunson and all those guys. And to sit out an entire World Series if they don't get the money out to him fast enough, I mean, that's huge to me.
Yeah.
That is just so huge. And I applaud him for it. I think that's fantastic. I mean, to do something like that, but... Oh my God! I mean, and I wonder if he sat down with Lederer and Ferguson and said, "Hey, look, I got to do this," you know, and if they advised him on it or whatever. I mean, it's just incredible to me that he did this.
Well, I'm certain that they would advise him not to sue him if that was the case. But before we continue, too, we should also mention that Full Tilt actually issued a release yesterday. Very sharply worded one, too, criticizing Phil for releasing this and saying that he's had opportunities to make this right with players and hasn't paid back some money he's owed, and a couple other things like that. So very interesting to see that they bit back very quickly. So obviously there's stuff going on behind the scenes that we probably will never know.
Right.
Unless this thing actually makes it to court. But crazy stuff.
It is. It is absolutely crazy. It's unprecedented, too. I mean, you never hear of anybody sitting out the World Series for anything, right?
Well, you know, the first thing that I thought of is, you know, no other player could have had this effect with this kind of announcement.
Right.
You know, you stop thinking, I'm like, you know, maybe Doyle Brunson, you know, godfather of poker, you know, if he come out and said, you know, hey, I'm not going to play the World Series because the site is not working in good faith with the players. But I don't even think he would have the same effect. And I think the reason is that I give Ivy credit for being respected by all poker players on some level.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost hard to not like Phil Ivy. If you don't like Phil Ivy, it's either because he's just so good and you don't like good players, or the fact that he has got this like J.D. Salinger kind of quality where he just doesn't he's just not out there. Aside from that, I mean, if he was a politician, I would have to think that he probably ranks in his favorability ratings are in like the 70s.
Yeah.
I would think, right?
Yeah, at least.
And the difference between him and Doyle is, I think, if you talk to some of the real old guard players who've been playing poker since we were all twinkles in our dad's eyes, I think they still give him a lot of respect, where they don't like these young guns, these 21-year-olds that think they know it all, right?
Right.
But at the same time, he's in that age group where I think all these new players coming up really respect him for being a young player and really, really skilled. So I think it really bridges the generation gaps probably better than any other player.
Yeah, I think Negreanu is something like that as well, but not to the extent that Ivy is.
And yeah, he's a polarizing figure, though.
Yeah,
difference,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. The other thing, too, about this is, it's not like him sitting out is going to motivate Full Tilt. That's the thing that's beautiful about this, is that he's genuinely upset about this and genuinely sitting out because he knows that players can't play in the World Series, and why should he play if they can't play? And I mean, it's not like what he's doing would motivate Full Tilt. You know what I mean? The suit might, but him sitting out, you know, has no effect on the suit, yet he's still doing it. I think that just speaks volumes about him.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about that a little bit, too. I mean, do you think that was a necessary step? I mean, not whether it's a good step or not, but I mean, we talked about how, you know, it's a bombshell that released and bombshell that he's suing. To me, that seems like that would have been enough to really get the point across. I don't know whether he needed to go this extra step. I certainly appreciate the fact that he did, but,
right.
You know, is he putting himself at – is he being a little too altruistic here? And we'll, for a minute put on the shelf whatever Tollweir is saying about him. A little too altruistic here at the expense of his career. You know, what I think about when I was thinking about this last night was, you know, all those great baseball players back in the World War II era that were at the prime of their career and then, you know, put down their bats and gloves and went and fight the war and came back, and they lost 3, 4, 5 years of a prime thing. And now you're looking back at 2011 and you're looking at their numbers for people who had no idea who these people were. And they don't really look as impressive as the players. So I'm wondering about that. Same with Ivy. I mean, he's probably, you know, unless something catastrophic happens, going to break all poker records by the time he's dead and gone. But losing a whole year of the series, that could be something that people 20 years, 40 years back look back and not really understand.
Yeah, I have to admit that was the first thing I thought was, why are you sitting out the World Series? I mean, it's not going to help your suit any. But at the same time, I thought, you know what? If you think back, there were decades that players didn't play. They just wanted to play the cash games because the World Series was,
yeah,
who cares?
True.
And then so Ivy's thinking, well, you know, if Brunson sat out for a decade, I can sit out for one.
1 year, yeah.
You know? But at the same time, I think he's still going to go to the office every day and play. He's still going to play the big games wherever they're playing. And,
right.
And maybe he'll play in the other series. And who knows? Maybe it'll spawn some sort of relationship with a different – you know, maybe the Aria, you know, he's got that room there and all that. Maybe he'll play there every day and people will go there. And maybe it's publicity for that, too. I don't know. But I don't think that's his drive for this. I think he really is upset by it. And I think he's making a statement. And he wanted to be as thorough with it as possible. I know what you're saying, though. I mean, I agree. When I first heard it, I thought, well, why are you doing that, man? Don't sit out the series. I want to see if you win some more bracelets. You know, he's one of my favorite players. But at the same time, I just, my hat's off to him. I think that it's noble, and you know, he's still going to make his money and everything. So yeah, the only thing he's losing out on is a chance to win $9 million in the main event, or, you know, a bracelet or two. So yeah, I don't know if, and that also tells me too that maybe those things aren't as important to him as we thought they were.
Yeah,
you know?
True, very true.
Or if they are that important to him, that it says even more about what he's doing. So no matter what you do, I mean, I don't think it was a wrong move. I agree with you. I I wish that he didn't have to do that, but in his mind he does. So, and maybe it'll happen. Maybe they'll get the money back to him and he'll be able to come in for the last 20 events or something. Who knows?
Well, you know, the other thing that really struck me about it, and it's not really a poker observation here, but just kind of a human element, press savvy kind of thing going on here. What he's saying here has so much more weight because of how he conducts himself.
Yeah.
That he's so private, that he doesn't get involved in things. I mean, I was thinking last night, what if this was Phil Hellmuth making a statement about UB?
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been anywhere near as big of a story, right?
Right.
Because that point, because then your players immediately think, oh, it's Phil Hellmuth. He's all about himself. He's trying to promote himself. This is a way for him to get some more publicity or make it about him. You can't say that about Phil Ivey. And I think the real interesting thing is it's kind of backed Full Tilt into a corner here a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know whether the stuff that Full Tilt's saying about him is true or not, but the bottom line is it's really tough for Full Tilt to fight back on this because here's a company that, for the most part, you know, despite the fact that Andy upset them hundreds of players and they never compensated us or returned any phone calls for 3 years. I have an admiration for the company. I don't think it's a dishonest company at all. I mean, there's other ones like that. But it's in the situation now where they haven't paid players out.
Yeah.
PokerStars has. So, and then you got a player that that just has so much ammunition because of how he carried himself. It makes it so much harder to really fight back other than send these real broiling press releases with, you know, accusations that they can't really follow up on.
The other thing, too, is let's just say that in a perfect world that the charges are dropped against Full Tilt and Stars and UB and all that, and Full Tilt's allowed to get licensed and play. You know, obviously, he's going to have no relationship with them again. Now, I mean, what's going to happen to that? I mean, maybe he's thinking that's never going to happen, so I might as well make this statement because I know I'm not going to be affiliated with Tilt again in the future. I don't know. I mean, I think Tilt is still going on internationally, right? I mean, they're still...
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about this too. I mean, the part of the Black Friday fallout is just changing the whole endorsement contract thing and, yeah. You know, are players valuable to a site anymore that can't... are American players valuable
right.
to
right.
a site that... I mean, obviously... international folks like this are fine, but you might be better off signing, you know, some up-and-coming Lithuanian player
yeah.
to get Lithuanian players to sign up for Full Tilt rather than a Phil Ivey. So I don't think that's a big deal so much, but Well, you know, the thing that I also thought was interesting, too, is in one of the response, I believe it was on 2+2 that Full Tilt responded to some ongoing things, and that says like this, but I did see a comment where they alluded to trying to raise the capital to make good on these debts.
Whoa.
And that was the first shocking thing I saw because I always assumed that these companies had safeguarded player money in a separate account.
Yeah.
You know, and just use the rake to pay their operating expenses and profits. And that comment led me to believe that, you know, some of these sites, and maybe Stars is like this too and just had were able to do it, but, you know, were treating themselves like a casino or like a bank where, you know, you didn't necessarily have money on hand to if every single person asked for a cash out, where I think we thought they would.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I read about Stars and that it said that Stars always kept players' monies in a different account that they never touched, but I don't know if that's totally
Well, they claim they did, and
right.
I have no reason not to believe that they didn't, and the difference really is that Stars was far more diversified from a player base. You know, they probably 50% of their players were Americans versus Full Tilt, which was far more than 50%.
Right.
So, I mean, even if Stars wasn't doing that, they were in a position that they were able to move money around to get all those cash outs and not really hurt them, you know. But I get a little off topic there. I don't want to suggest that that's what happened. But Tilt obviously is not in that same case, you know, with so many Americans, and maybe they just didn't have the money to pay it out. Maybe that's really what's going on here. I don't know. It certainly seems like that's what Ivy is suggesting in a way.
Well, I'm very glad that we got our money off of Stars almost instantly, and I didn't have any money on Tilt. I don't know if you did, but I had money on Tilt.
Yeah,
so
haven't played there for 3 years.
Me neither.
Thank you very much. All right, well, we got a great mailbag this week, Chris. It was submitted a while back, and when we still had those Apes free rolls. Marcus, Arliss, don't miss you so much. So this mailbag's been collecting dust, waiting for one of our mailbag shows since Bernice Q, the author, is a previous swag winner. But in honor of next week's Atlantic City meetup, Chris.
Yeah.
Which we're hoping Bernice will be able to attend. I'm going to dust it off and use it here. And it's a multi-pronged question. And I think it's real interesting. I want to hear what you had to say about it.
Okay.
All right. So this is, remember, this is back during one of the Apes free rolls many months ago. She said, during a recent free roll, we were down to about 13 people, 10 winning entries. One player, who she said was either out of the tournament or perhaps never entered, posted in the chat at her table a plea for players to play soft. So the one player disconnected, the one disconnected player left wouldn't cash. All right, we got it?
Yeah.
All right, he says that disconnected player had about 19K in chips, so clearly he wasn't disconnected the whole tourney, but recently left or lost his connection. So first question she wants to know is, why does he deserve to lose for all of us to basically stop playing so he doesn't win an entry? Clearly he built a big enough stack that he could contend for an entry without having to play near the end. Isn't that a valid way to win an entry? As valid as playing competitively and making the final 10. And why should the attorney take another 45 minutes to end just so we can wait for that person to be blinded out? And she keeps going, Chris. Hold on.
Oh, my God.
And why does a short stack deserve to cash when the disconnected player had built a bigger stack along the way? She said the whole thing felt like collusion and was unfair to ask anyone to stop playing his or her best so one person, for an arbitrary reason, should not win. This player, if it matters, she said, was from a city that showed he probably wasn't an interloper. It probably does matter. So she's interested in the nation's thought on this, so we'll see what the nation says after the show. But let's start with you, and wow, 40 questions there, so jump right in where you want.
Well, I guess I'll start with the beginning. When she said that you know, the person had built up a good stack and then went away, and she's saying, you know, why do they deserve to lose just so that person doesn't win an entry? And I totally agree with her. Hey, he could have just sat there and folded every hand if he wanted to, and you wouldn't think the less of it. So what's the difference, right? Yeah. I mean, I paid my money to, or whatever. I entered this tournament. And I built up my stack, and, you know, what's the difference between me sitting there and folding or me watching a rerun of Seinfeld while the tournament ticks on? So I agree with her there. There's no reason why that person should not be awarded a seat, because they did build up a big enough stack to outlast everyone else. And the other thing too was, you know, it is collusion. If everyone gets together with a common goal to gang up against someone or something, it's collusion. That's all there is to it. There's no other way around it. That's collusion. If everybody at the table said, "Yeah, let's agree to just fold every hand until it gets there," then yeah, it's collusion.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's not that I haven't been a part of that. I mean, I have to be honest that I've, you know. One time we all agreed to fold while we waited for the moderator or whatever you call it to come while we were doing a chop.
Right.
But that's not the same thing. That's just us agreeing not to play the hands because we couldn't figure out how to make it stop dealing hands or whatever. We were all idiots and didn't realize, just all sit out. And then, but at the time we didn't know. But yeah, no, that's absolutely 100% correct to me, at least, that this person should be able to do whatever they want with their cards. They got into the tournament, they won their chips, and they could do what they want with them. So that's one thing. The other thing is, yeah, why should the short stack be awarded a seat because he wasn't good enough or she wasn't good enough to get a big enough stack to earn a seat on their own? You know, so I don't know. I totally agree with her, though. I think that 19K in chips is enough, and if that person is either disconnected or chooses sit out, then that's their prerogative, and they shouldn't be penalized because some idiot chimes in on the chat and says, "Don't let that guy win a seat. He's not playing." I mean, that's ridiculous. So I don't know how many questions I answered there.
I think you got a lot of them there. Yeah. You know, when I read this, I thought one of these fantasy baseball leagues I'm in, and you know, I joined it, and it's on Yahoo. Yahoo has all these rules. You can customize leagues however you want. I'm like, great. Read the rules, and then I get to the draft, and they give me another Trapper Keeper full of new rules.
Oh, jeez.
I'm like, what are these? And they're like, well, you know, 2 years ago, Joe did this, and we didn't like it, so we made a rule against it. And so I was like, okay. I mean, why can't you just change the rules on Yahoo and then not worry about this if you don't like how he played? So I guess that's my point on this is, you know, I get the whole gentlemanly thing that we should play in the spirit of the game. It sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
Yes.
Play in the spirit of the game. The bottom line, there's rules.
Yep.
If you want that spirit of the game to be played, then change the rules. You know, so you don't have to worry about that. So from my point of view, a couple things. One, you have to remember, you have to divorce yourself from the person in the stack. In a real honest assessment, the entry in the tournament is that stack of chips. It's not the person.
Right.
The person moves the chips around, but it's that stack. I mean, you see that every day in a tournament where, you know, they're taking chips out of a stack that no one exists. And, you know, if somebody got up at the World Series of Poker and left for whatever reason, that stack is still there.
Yep.
And it's still competitive.
Yep.
You know, if you don't like the fact that someone built up 19K and then walked away, then you need to change the rules. And say something like, hey, you missed three blinds, you're removed from the tournament or something like that. But until that day, you know, whatever you want to do within the rules is legal. I mean, I guess this borders onto some kind of an angle shooting question, which I'm sure I'll get flamed about, and maybe I'll change my mind. But essentially, if it's the rule, it's the rule.
And that's not angle shooting. To me, at least in this case, obviously it's not, because, you know, he could just sat there and folded. So, I mean, it's no different than him folding manually or folding automatically. So to me, that's not angle shooting. And then, like in a live tournament, like you said, you know what? My stack is still there. You can still take my blinds as if I was sitting here and folding anyway. So I don't see how it is an angle shoot either. So I don't think you have to worry about people folding for that.
Yeah, I wasn't meant that. I just meant that, you know, angle shooting by definition is playing within the rules but not within the spirit of the game. So, you know, not particularly this example, but there are other examples where people might say, hey, Scott, you've complained about this on the show before, which is true. I mean, so I guess that's also the difference is you can complain about things you don't like, but it's different to insist that players adjust to that.
Right.
You know?
And the other thing, too, she said was, do we really have to make the tournament last another 45 minutes because we want him to be blinded out? You know what I mean? Because that's what they're saying is basically, you know, don't play a hand until this guy's stack is gone. So they're going to sit there and wait while they sit there and blind this guy out and then move on. It's just ridiculous to ask that, too. On top of it, not even, you know, the fact that it's collusion anyway. But on top of that, now you're like, all right, let's sit around. And actually, it's probably more than 45 minutes. 19,000,
yeah,
you know, in chips at a free roll is probably a pretty decent stack and probably going to be a lot longer than that. So, yeah, it's ridiculous to ask all those people to sit around 45 minutes because they want the short stack to get a seat. Hey, you know what? Play better.
You know, and you can't guarantee that this guy isn't going to come back.
Yep.
40 minutes into this.
Yep. He might even
start playing,
sit back down,
and then it could cost you a seat because you were trying to be a nice guy. So.
Yep.
And then I think the final point too is, and I know people are tired of hearing me say online poker is a wild, wild west, but it is. I mean, one of the things that I think you have to accept is when you log on to an online poker site, if you're fortunate to live in a country where you can do that, is that there are things that are out of your control that could impact your game, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you could lose your internet connection. Your power could go out. The cute little kid that you put down for the nap an hour ago might wake up because he's scared of the boogeyman. You know, there's things that are out of your control. That's not my problem on the other end of the connection.
That's right.
Your problem alone.
That's
so,
right.
You know, when you sign on, this stuff happens. So, you know, we get into these discussions before, hey, somebody lost their connection. Should we all wait till he comes back on? No. You know, I would never ask anybody to do that for me because I accepted the risk when I decided to play this form of game. It has nothing about being a gentleman or a lady. It's, you know, just understanding the rules of the game. So,
absolutely.
Wow. We kind of glossed right over that one, I guess, right? All right, Bernice, we always appreciate when you contribute to the Yanny Up Nation. Obviously, you have swag, so we won't say anything. But hopefully we'll see you Friday at the Yanny Up Meetup at the Atlantic City. But everybody else, email us at podcast@yannyupmagazine.com, and we'll send you something great, like maybe a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Yanny Up store at antiupstore.com.
So far, Scott, it's like a tri-state poker cast. I mean, we had Ivy on, who's from, originally used to play in Atlantic City in the Jersey area.
Right.
Bernice Q, who I think is like somewhere in Brooklyn or something.
Brooklyn, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And now we're going to Thietza,
Yep.
At our hotline, and of course she's from that area too, and I'm from Connecticut. That's part of the tri-state area. So far, you're the only oddball on the show, but then again, that's true every week. All right, so she calls in and wants to know about something she could do remotely for online play.
I'm not tech savvy, but I am able to VPN remote access to the work computer and home computer. Why can't people do that with PokerStars or Full Tilt, especially PokerStars? Why can't they VPN into some server in Europe and get access? Anybody know the answer to that? I'd love to know.
Well, first of all, we've got to say that she's going to be at our Atlantic City meetup as well, Chris.
Yes.
Wearing bells, she said, and I believe it. I believe she'll actually have bells on. But to her answer, all right, I'm going to be honest. I am not a computer geek, all right? So I do not understand this stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm going to guess that remote access, even if it does work, remember you have to have your account set up places as well too,
right?
So I think that's gonna be the problem, isn't it?
Well, I don't remember all of the details, but I did have a conversation about this with our chubby reporter in Nevada, Big Dave, when I was out for the, it might have been for the November 9, I was staying with him, and he had told me that people in England, you know, they can literally sign up for an account over there. And then you instant message them or call them or whatever and say, hey, okay, I want to play some poker. And they would literally just turn on their computer, sign on to whatever site it is that you're playing on. And then there's this sort of program, a remote access thing, like she was mentioning on the call, that you can sign in on your computer and it uses their IP address, it uses their everything, and you're playing in that account over there through your computer over here.
Right.
And so I do think that it's possible. Obviously, there are some computer people out there that are so smart that to them it's probably simple. But to us, it sounds a little complicated, and I'm sure that it's something that I couldn't figure out on my own. But according to him and according to some other people that I've talked to, that, yeah, I think it is possible that you could do it somehow with that remote access. Because I think that there was some other instance he gave me where he actually needed to do something, or one of his friends need to do something like that, but it wasn't for this, it wasn't for poker, but it was something else, and he literally had to, I think it might have been the other way around too, England had to have the computer turned on in America to do something, or whatever it was, I don't know. And they did it. He called them up, said, hey, turn on your computer for me, I want to play tonight, or something, or I need to do this act, this whatever it is, and that's it, and it worked that way. So it's kind of like that Citrix program where you can get access to your computer at work while you're home or something. So it's possible, I think.
Well, I'd be interested to hear from our nation and our great members of the Binary Bunch, who I'm sure have looked into this and know the trips and tips and tricks for it, and whether they ran into any brick walls doing it. So let us know. But everybody else, remember to call the hotline, 813-448-1120. We'll send you something wonderful. Tietz, of course, already has something. But everybody else might get something great like a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up, also now available in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com.
You're a pretty good salesman, buddy.
I try, thanks.
Okay, a call to the floor this week. It comes from Andy via email, and it's for our good friend Jody. And it says, on a 1-3 no-limit hold'em cash game, the hand went to showdown, and his wife and her opponent checked the river with about a $60 pot on the line. He said she turned over ace-queen for a pair of aces, and the opponent announces pair of eights. Flips over the hand, dealer announces eights, and then ships the pot to his wife, who had aces. He starts to deal the next hand, and the player next to her opponent says, wait a minute, you had a flush, meaning the person who had eights also had a flush. The dealer stops and calls the floor. Floor comes over, but the dealer continues to deal. I was under the gun and stopped playing until I realized about 30 seconds later I was told to act while the floor was there. My wife was in the big blind, and she stops action to talk about the previous hand. The floor listens to the arguments and then says he'll be back. Action continues, and this hand, his wife gets nearly stacked with her trip queens, losing to a boat. Needless to say, now she's worried about losing the rest of her money on the floor's decision. Floor rules that the hand in question was not contested properly, and she got shipped the pot based on the misrepresentation. So she got to keep the pot, but he has two questions. First, was that correct? And second, should action have continued while the floor was there, or should have there been a pause? And this is one of the reasons why I'm so glad there are floors and management in poker rooms, because I don't even know what to say to this.
All right, well, this is what Jody Russell wrote back to us. He said, when a player wishes to contest a pot, it must be done before the next hand begins. Once the next hand has started, it is too late. So, yes, the ruling to allow your wife to keep the pot was correct. Since the pot was being contested after it was too late, it was also correct to not stop the action. There are instances in which a player may be asking the dealer questions about what just happened, and while answering the questions, the dealer starts the next hand. At some point during situations like this, the player will sometimes ask for a decision once they decide they are dissatisfied with the situation. When this happens, the floor staff should be able to recognize the pot was being contested before the next hand began and should know to stop the action of the hand in progress until a ruling is made on the previous hand.
Makes sense.
Very confusing.
Yeah, makes sense, though.
Yeah.
And back when I was very naive and very early in my poker career when I only played tournaments, I recall... this to show you how naive I was, I recall a hand I got knocked out of a tournament on, and everyone had made a straight, or no, three guys had made a straight or something, or two of them, and I didn't even realize that I was one of the guys that would have made a straight, but they mucked my cards and knocked me out of the tournament. And as I was driving home, I was like, oh my god, I had that straight too, I should still be in the tournament. And I really thought about actually like going back or calling them up and telling them, and I want my chips back, and I get back into the tournament. I thought you could do that. You know, that's how naive I was.
Well, I don't know if it's obviously it's naive, but I mean, I don't think it's embarrassing at all to think. I mean, you want actions to be rectified,
right?
The way they were, if you can. What I think people need to understand is that you know, you got to do it in due process. It's not like, you know, You wake up 60 days after you bought something, you take it back to Walmart, and they're saying, hey, it's been 30 days. You know, it's the same kind of deal. I mean, there's got to be a statute of limitations on things, and certainly when the next hand starts, I think it's a good one. So, you know, my takeout from this is, you know, if you have any question at all about the hand, ask the dealer to stop the action right away until it's clarified. You know, you don't talk to your buddy and go, hey, you know what, I think while the deal's going on, and then that's your problem. So I know some people are hesitant to say that because they don't want to look like an idiot, you know, and say, you know, when people say, oh, no, you didn't have a flush. Oh, okay, sorry, you know. but understand, if you don't do that, you lose the option to be made whole there. So so definitely, I mean, that's the bottom line. If it was contested properly, then it might be in a different situation. But you know, it also brings up another thing I was interested about. I don't think I've ever had this situation, and if I have, it's never been too stressful on me, but I'm worried that it's going to happen someday, is I'm awarded a pot incorrectly like this.
Right.
And then I have somebody at the other table saying, hey, I had the right hand, and two or three people saying, yes, he did, and I've already got the chips in my stack. I think that's an uncomfortable situation to be in, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I actually got a little pit in my stomach reading this before it got to the end and she got to win the pot, because I wondered, oh my god, what's she going to do? Because then what do you do?
Oh, in this situation, it's even crazier.
Yeah.
If you lost that money by the time they rule, that would be really weird. But in general, I mean, I'm just worried that day is going to come, because I don't want to be in that situation where I did nothing wrong.
Right.
You know, I showed my cards. I was pushed the pot. Maybe I didn't pay attention to what the other person had or anything like that. But I did nothing wrong, and now I've got people, after the hand's gone and the cards aren't there for me to verify, telling me, hey, I need to give me the pot back.
Right.
Because, I mean, the strict interpretation, it'd be easy for me to say, probably what I would say is, you know, hey, I'm sorry, I didn't see it. I've got the pot. I don't know you were right. I'm going to keep it. But that creates some bad blood.
No, absolutely.
Wrong, you know?
Absolutely.
Same time, I don't want to just go, okay, you're right, and give the guy a bunch of chips that he may not have won.
Yeah. It gets back to that gentlemanly game thing, too. I mean, you know, it's tough. It's tough to... I'm glad that kind of situation doesn't happen that often. You know what I mean? If something like that doesn't really occur that often. Because if that happened a lot, you know, if there, that's why you rely on quality dealers and quality management and stuff like that, because that happened a lot. The game would be reverting back to the Wild Wild West, and no one would want to play it, so that's pretty wild.
I just try to think of those things ahead of time so I'm prepared, and I haven't really prepared a good reaction to that one quite yet.
Well, you know, you brought up the meetup a couple of times, and I just want to remind everyone that the Atlantic City meetup is 8 p.m. Friday, June 10th at Harrah's Atlantic City, and we're going to play a $70 little mini tournament for everybody who shows up, and then followed by cash games. You know, hopefully we'll play some mixed games. Like we said last week, you know, it's New Jersey, so we should be able to play some mixed games there and enjoy some stud. Yeah. And then
and our roster of folks coming is growing by the day. You know, our good friend Lauren Finkelstein, on the show often. He's going to be there.
Awesome.
El Snarfo Grande emailed me today. He got the pass from the wife. She's staying home with kids. He's going to be there. And, of course, we mentioned Bernice Q is going to try to make it there, Tietza. So it's going to be a nice little get-together of folks that you've heard on the show before. So if you can get there, and we'd love to have time to play with you and talk to you.
And then, of course, if you missed that one, but you're headed to Vegas at the end of the month, or actually the beginning of next month, 8 p.m. Friday again, and it's going to be July 1st at the Palms Casino, figuring that it's right across from the Rio, and real convenient, and it's a nice little room. I've played there often. Same thing, $70 mini tournament followed by cash games, and hopefully somebody will attend both other than just me and you. I want to see if there's a third person who makes it to both of these meetups. That would be pretty cool.
We might have to dig deep into the swag shelf here to find something to reward folks that make both of those. But I'll find something for them. It may not be anything terrific, but I'll try to make it as terrific as possible.
And if you want to go for the trifecta...
Oh, there we go. Now we're talking.
And come on our cruise, August 29th to September 2nd. It's still just $369 per person, but that price is only guaranteed till June 13th. Don't forget, anteupmagazine.com/cruise. You can find everything you need to know about our trip to the Bahamas, and that's going to be a nice one. It's going to be a pretty packed poker room, so we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, Lee Childs and a little casino package, a lot of good stuff going on. And then finally, you got just a couple days to let us know what poker players you'll put on the money.
Yeah,
we're going to do that show next week. We're going to tape it early because, remember, we're on our way to Atlantic City. So get those in right away, and I'll be interested to see if Phil Ivey rates a little higher on some people's list in the next couple days.
There used to be a $1,000 bill. Is that still in circulation?
I might put I don't believe so, yeah.
Because he's 10 times the man he was last week.
Ooh, I like it. I like it a lot.
All right, let's see what's piling up on the Ante Up news desk.
Victory Poker, which entered the online poker market with a bang just more than a year ago, has ceased online play and has become an affiliate site for Cake Poker in the wake of the Black Friday actions.
So tell me what that means, Scott. Tell me exactly what that means.
Well, it's not like the CEO just decided right after Black Friday that he didn't want to get wrapped up in this. He didn't want his players' money to get caught up. So he was just going to shut it down. He was already working on moving to the Cake Network anyhow. So now it's just, I guess, an affiliate site. You go to Victory Poker and you sign up for Cake.
Oh, okay. So it's just a...
Makes money on affiliate deals now.
Affiliate deals, yeah. Okay, that's cool.
Fairly shocking, but also, I mean, I guess it's been interesting to me to watch how different online sites have treated Black Friday. I mean, we had a, you know, SureBet, our great cruise sponsor this year, was getting ready to launch, and he decided, you know, hey, I'm not going to get in this market now.
Yeah.
I'll go international, and then you got a site like this that's up and probably could have profited handsomely from it, saying, you know what, I'm not going to take the chance.
Okay.
And then other sites going, ooh, hey. Come on, players.
The thing about it, too, is it had so many big names assigned to it, and you know, you thought that it was going to have a chance to really flourish and do well, and then boom,
yeah.
Black Friday just kills everything. It's just remarkable how one little thing can just end so many other great things. But okay, the Premier League Poker has been rebranded as World Poker Tour Premier League Poker, presented by PartyPoker.com. That's a mouthful, I would say, right there.
It is.
And it has a 16-player, $125,000 buy-in event scheduled this year that will be filmed for European television.
That's the WPT PLP.
Man, PLP PB PPC.
I feel like Judge Reinhold on Beverly Hills Cop 3 there.
That's crazy, man.
And finally, Eric Lindgren and Erica Schoenberg were married last week in front of many other poker pros and reportedly are honeymooning at the World Series of Poker.
Man, I wonder if Benjamin was invited to that wedding.
Well, you know. Some people have a very good breakup. You never know.
No, I know. That's what I mean. I just wonder if they're, still, friendly or whatever, and if they're, I would think they would be. I mean, they're going to cross paths so many times in life, so. But, wow, I never thought E-Dog would get married.
Yeah, reportedly the guest list included Negreanu and Hellmuth, so.
Yeah, that's not shocking. I couldn't make it because, the budget for Annie Up only allows us to go to Vegas once, so.
Yeah, I had to click the decline thing there. But actually, no, they apparently were married here in Florida, Chris. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
So you probably should have done mileage.
Yeah, so if I had known that, I would have just gone.
Yeah, you got to read the invites a little closer.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Once I saw they're only offering chicken, I didn't want to go. Want to learn how to really make money at the World Series? Join Pro Poker Seminars with special guest Dr. Alan Schoonmaker in Vegas, June 27th through 29th. Small group intensive seminars on live sit-and-goes, cash games, and multi-table tournaments. Visit ProPokerSeminars.com and use bonus code ERIC50, that's ERIC50, to get $50 off the cash game or multi-table seminars. With the World Series kicking off this week, every poker player has Las Vegas on the mind, and we thought who better to educate our listeners with the ins and outs of Sin City Poker than Annie Up's Las Vegas ambassador. While we appreciate having him represent Annie Up now, Michael Hamai's main gig continues to be the reigning Vegas poker expert at website allvegaspoker.com, the preeminent source of Vegas poker news. Hey, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And what an exciting time to be in Las Vegas right now. World Series of Poker started up, and yeah, it's the best time of year to be a poker player in Las Vegas.
Awesome.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. But right now, I got to tell you, Michael, I've been visiting Las Vegas for many years now, and the one site I never forget to check before hopping on a plane is allvegaspoker.com. Tell our listeners a little bit about the site, what they'll find there, and how you got involved with it.
Absolutely. AllVegasPoker.com was founded in 2004, and it has always been a way for the casual Las Vegas poker player or the serious player to find out exactly what's going on in the rooms and what to play, what they're looking for. I mean, Las Vegas has 58 poker rooms, and almost every single one of them is on AVP. And we have pictures of every room, a complete tournament database, so that way players will know if they want to play a $60 tournament or if they want to play a $300 tournament. We provide the structures, the times, what they can expect as far as cash games, and even the traffic levels in the room. And we cover everything from cocktail service to comps. So it's a great site for anybody wanting to learn about what's going on and where in Las Vegas poker.
Now, you mentioned a couple minutes ago about, it's just a great time of year to be there. And you even wrote about that in your column and why it's so good to be there. Obviously, all of us look forward to the pilgrimage each year to go there. But, what's it like being in Vegas as a local during the series?
It's really still a great time for the locals for the simple reason that during the rest of the poker year or the rest of the regular year in Las Vegas, the games are steady, but a lot of times it's the same players with a rotating group of tourists. During the World Series, it's like poker on acid. I mean, every single room is just packed with players, and many people would think, oh, well, they're all World Series serious players. Believe me, there's a reason why all the pros are playing at the Rio, because the money is soft, the games are soft, and it's just a great situation. Even the small, dinky locals rooms are affected by the World Series, because most poker players, as we all know, are cheap and stay off strip, and it makes, the poker rooms great even 5 miles off the strip. So it really has a ripple effect throughout the entire city, and to see the poker rooms with, lists deep and having rooms that normally would have three games have eight, or rooms that normally have 20 games have 50. I mean, it's really just a great time to find all the action you've ever wanted in Las Vegas, and we try to cover that at All Vegas Poker.
Well, obviously you mentioned that there's an overflow, so it's not all the action is not at the Rio. I mean, obviously there's all these great tournament series that have cropped up, the Grand at the Nugget, the Binion's Classic, the Venetian, Caesars. What are some of the rooms that really do see a bump during this besides the Rio?
Well, and in my June column, I really kind of stress the fact that one of the most common fallacies is the fact that that Rio is where all the action is, and that is simply by no means the case. The entire strip, every poker room, you know, Bellagio's busy all year, but now you're going to see rooms that people may not at first think about: Treasure Island, Bally's, Excalibur. It's just random rooms are suddenly just full of players, and it makes it convenient because a lot of players, you know, maybe can't afford to stay at Venetian, they're staying at Bally's or staying at Treasure Island, and they can still find some great games, you know, even in those rooms. And of course, as you mentioned, the tournament series, the Rio obviously offers great bracelet events, which starting at $1,000, but they also offer a daily $200 tournament. And the only reason Rio started doing that was because they were getting so much competition from the strip rooms offering better value daily tournaments. The Venetian, being the best example, offers a great daily tournament as well as their deep stack, and their daily tournament starting at $120, I believe. And then they also have their deep stacks, which are $300, which, you know, granted, you don't get a bracelet for winning them, but some of these prize pools for a $300 tournament are eclipsing $25,000 for first place. Man. So, you know, it's, you don't see that, you know, in a lot of other places. And you're seeing that here. Caesars, is, as you said, is running a tournament series. Binion's downtown, they're getting 150 players for some of their tournaments. Venetian's eclipsing 300 for their tournaments. Aria's getting $80 for their daily $125 tournament, which normally gets 40 to 50 players. So it's, you know, you're really seeing that effect all across town. And it's for every budget. You can play a great tournament with 80 players for $45. And I just don't see any other time you can do that except during the World Series.
Well, you know, you brought up a lot of different rooms there. And your first column for us, actually, you know, you talked about there are 58 rooms in the Vegas Valley. And there are, you know, there are three categories you put them in. I thought this was really interesting. There are destination rooms, convenience rooms, and then local rooms. Could you give us sort of a taste of what each of those are and exactly some rooms that would fit into those categories?
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be my pleasure. The first rooms to cover are the destination rooms. And these are the rooms that I think that Bob from Atlanta, when he thinks of Las Vegas poker, these are the rooms he thinks about. These are Venetian, Bellagio, Wynn, Aria. Those are the rooms that they're really catering to poker players. Players will leave where they're staying. Let's say they're staying at Luxor, and they're going to say, I'm going to play poker today. Luxor has its own poker room, but they're going to get in their rental car, and they're going to drive to Venetian. Because Venetian has, throughout the year, normally they have 39 tables. During the World Series, they go up to, I think, 150, but don't quote me on that. That might be incorrect. But they increase a lot of tables, and those are the destination rooms. Those are beautiful rooms. They offer, you know, high-end cocktail service. They don't drop a jackpot drop. They are rooms that people, it's a destination for people to go and play poker there. They're not necessarily staying in the hotel. The next category is convenience rooms. The vast majority of poker rooms in Las Vegas are convenience rooms. And these are rooms that are usually, they are less than 20 tables. Most of them are actually 12 tables or less. And they are rooms that are designed mainly for the player staying in the hotel. They're designed for walk-by traffic, and they're designed for local players. So those are the rooms that probably the most people that visit Las Vegas play in. Those rooms are Treasure Island, Bally's, Excalibur, Flamingo. Any room that's 15 tables or less is a convenience room. There's destination rooms, I think there's a total of six, maybe seven, depending if you want to consider a couple of the bigger rooms destination rooms. Most of them are catering more toward the convenience level. Convenience rooms all drop a jackpot drop, which is used for high hand jackpots, free rolls, bad beat jackpots, that sort of thing. And that is the convenience rooms. That's most rooms in Las Vegas. The final category is locals rooms. Locals rooms are rooms that are off the strip. They cater mainly to local players. Stations are locals rooms, all the station casinos, even Red Rock, even though it has a large tourist clientele as well. Orleans is probably the most quintessential locals room. It is a room that is mainly locals. It has the lowest rake in Las Vegas at $3 plus one for jackpot. And it's a room that is, once again, it's a locals room. It's also the biggest locals room. It has over 30 tables. Granted, a lot of those are for tournament only. But it's another room that caters mainly to those that live in Las Vegas. Now, that doesn't mean that tourists aren't welcome there and can't play there. It just means that most of the players there are players that are playing every day or playing close to it, and they usually reside in Las Vegas. Those rooms also usually run promotions that are geared toward local players, like free rolls, $100,000 free rolls that you have 3 months to qualify for. Obviously, a tourist can't really take advantage of that promotion because they're not going to be here for 3 months and they can't come back in 3 months to play the tournament. So once again, those rooms kind of cater to the locals market. Those include stations, South Point, Silverton, Orleans. Those are the locals casinos in the three different markets.
That's awesome. Now, is there a chance for these rooms to move around on that list? Like, have you ever seen a convenience room become a destination room or something like that?
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that it's the exact opposite of that is actually happening. And that's why I hesitate to say exactly which rooms are destination rooms. Usually a convenience room does not become a destination room. It's the other way around. A destination room can become a convenience room. And I think the best example of that is the Mirage. The Mirage, most poker players, at least ones that watch TV or watch movies, have heard of the Mirage. We all know Rounders, where Mike McDermott talks about, you know, it's where Phil Hellmuth his office. Phil Hellmuth hasn't set foot in Mirage probably 10 years, but that's okay, because what happens is that the manager at Mirage, it's a new manager to the Mirage, but he's been in Vegas for 30 years. His name is Christopher Coffin. He's a great guy, and he viewed the Mirage as what it was. It's no longer the room where all the big pros go. It's not the room where all these the high limit players go. And, you know, Doyle Brunson doesn't sit in the corner playing 2,000, 4,000 there anymore. With the opening of Bellagio, with the opening of Aria, the Mirage was no longer in that pack. So what did he do? He added a jackpot drop, which many people were just shocked at. The Mirage is now dropping a jackpot, because that usually takes you, as soon as you add a jackpot, you're usually taken out of destination status, because that means you're kind of catering to tourists versus catering to the serious players. So Mirage added a jackpot drop. They started adding a progressive Royal Flush jackpot. They added some great promotions, and honestly, they have great games. It's one of my favorite places to play. But it's not technically a destination room anymore. It's a very large room. I mean, they have 19 tables, which they've actually taken out quite a few tables, but they're down to 19 tables. And they get 1-2 no limit every day, and they get 3-6 every day. That's their basic spread. And during the World Series, they pick up 2-5. But, you know, that's, once again, all those things put together equals a convenience room versus a destination room. Now, that's not to say that people don't go and say, I want to play poker at the Mirage. It's the Mirage. And that's wonderful, because I think it's a great room and it's worth playing in. But, you know, once again, that's not really a destination room. That really qualifies it into the convenience category. Another example of that is Caesar's Palace. Caesar's Palace is kind of on the fence. I personally believe it's a convenience room, and I think a lot of people would agree with me. I don't think Caesar's management would, but it's a room that really kind of decided at one point they added a jackpot drop. They severely altered their cocktail service. They really kind of, and by altered I mean downgraded, their cocktail service. And they are a room that is really a convenience room. During the World Series, it's a destination room, but the rest of the year, it's a convenience room. So, you know, that's another situation like that. Other than that, for the most part, it's pretty set. If a poker room opens and it's 8 tables, it's not a destination room, plain and simple.
Makes sense.
Well, my wife and I were married to the Sahara and have great memories there. And one of the great memories is they used to have these great little daily tournaments I played in every time I was out there.
Very popular.
Yeah, even though the room wasn't really much to speak of. But obviously, sadly, the Sahara closed this month. Who's picked up the business since the Landmark closed?
Absolutely.
What's going to be the follow-up?
This was actually a hot-button topic on allvegaspoker.com as well, because, as you said, the Sahara tournament was unique. It was the 7 o'clock tournament. They ran it 3 times a day. They ran it at 11, 7, and 11. And it was a $45 buy-in with a single $20 rebuy. The rake was horrendous. I mean, there's no question. They were raking upwards of 33% off the initial buy-in. But see, what people didn't take into account was they didn't rake anything off the rebuy. So, and like 98% of the people took the rebuy. So that decreased the rake to the more manageable, 20% levels, mid 20% levels, which is reasonable for a $65 tournament. And their 7 p.m. would get, a few times that I played it, it was over 170 players, which you think about it. I mean, that's paying $3,000 for first place on a $65 tournament.
Wow.
So it was, you know, and that was at its peak. I think more recently, until their closure, they were getting about 100 to 120 players. Now, with the Sahara closing, the first casino to jump on that market was the Stratosphere, right across the street. It makes sense. It's diagonal from where the old Sahara is. So the poker room manager at Stratosphere is actually the former Sahara manager. So, they transitioned some of the staff over there. They took some of their poker dealers under their wing, and they decided to just do it the easy way and mirror it. I mean, they literally mirrored Sahara's old structure verbatim over at the Stratosphere. And they also added some tables there. Now, from what I hear from my friends at Stratosphere, they have not mirrored the numbers that Sahara had, but they're not doing poorly. I mean, they're getting 70 to 80 when Sahara was getting 120 to 130. So, given how recently Sahara closed, I think that over time, those original Sahara numbers will return to where the Stratosphere is. And I think it will continue to go up. I mean, it was a very popular structure. A lot of players play that tournament three times a day, every day. So you're going to see the Stratosphere pick up more numbers because they decided to mirror Sahara's former structure and opportunity. I mean, it was 8,000 chips for a $65 buy-in, 20-minute levels. I mean, to a serious player, it's kind of a joke, but I would honestly see some high-level pros playing that tournament just because it was fun. it's a fun tournament.
Hey, since you're knee-deep in it, what do you think is unique about Vegas poker?
Wow. It's a great question. I think the most unique aspect of Vegas poker, and I have played poker in several other jurisdictions. I've played in Atlantic City. I'm from the Los Angeles area, so I used to play at Commerce quite a bit in the bike. What makes Las Vegas different is the proximity of action. I mean, there are 58 rooms all within about a 20 to 30 mile radius. And, there's 10 rooms all next door to each other on each side of the strip. Plus, I mean, this is the strip alone has almost 800 poker tables. So it's just what makes Las Vegas poker different is that if you don't like one room, you're going to walk about an eighth of a mile and you'll be in another room, or you're going to cross the street. You can go from playing in an 8-table room to playing in a 50-table room. Well, the Venetian during their deep stack, normally they're about a 39. So you can go from playing Treasure Island with that has 8 tables, go over to Venetian that's 39 tables, and then go to Mirage that has 19 tables, and you'll never basically we'll only have to cross the street one time. So that makes Las Vegas quite different. Another thing that I think is unique to Las Vegas is joint property promotions, which I, from what I've been told, is not common in other jurisdictions. And that's they like Stations casinos. This is more of a local thing. They have a bad beat jackpot that starts at like $100,000 and is progressive. And if you hit that jackpot in any casino within Stations, you will everybody who's playing in every Stations casino will get a piece of that jackpot.
Yeah.
And that's not something you really see in other jurisdictions, because we happen to have 10 plus casinos all connected that actually pool their jackpot money together, and that way they can pay every single person playing in the poker room when a jackpot hits. That's something that I think is also uniquely Las Vegas.
Awesome.
Well, you mentioned the Orleans, Michael, and nowhere have I lost more money in my career than at the has to be the toughest room I've ever played in. Does that room have a reputation for being tough, or do I just suck at poker?
That room has a reputation of being nitty, so maybe you just haven't figured out how to beat the nits. The Orleans is the like I said earlier, it's the quintessential locals room. I don't consider this bashing when I say that the average age of that poker room is probably close to 60, but that room is packed. And during the World Series, the room has even better action than it normally has. What makes the Orleans unique is that it's the only room, and it used to be the only room, now Venetian's actually picked this up, that had 4-8 Omaha 8 or better 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yep.
And that was something that you didn't see. I mean, obviously you haven't seen Omaha spread in some of these rooms ever. Venetian decided to pick it up, and obviously the Venetian players are a different caliber than the Orleans. But if you want to see an action-packed 4-8-0-8 game, Orleans is like everyone knows. It's like, oh, you want to play 4-8-0-8? You go to Orleans. And granted, if you're 40, you'll be the youngest person at the table. But it makes you feel young. But it's the Orleans, it's a nitty room, but you know what? They got a lot of games, they have great action, and honestly, if you're a solid player, beating the nits is not that hard. Just be prepared for them to throw their coffee at you when you win with 7-9.
Well, related to that, we got a call this morning from a listener who wanted to know, he's going out to the World Series, wants to know what some of the softer rooms he can hit up are. But what are some of the tougher rooms that newbies should avoid on the first trip, and what are some of the softer rooms that they might want to?
Well, okay. I'm going to go ahead and assume that that a typical newbie or somebody who's new to Las Vegas is looking for 1-2 No Limit. I mean, I'm obviously not going to sit here and tell you, well, what are the best 5-10 games? I mean, there's two rooms that spread 5-10 in Las Vegas, or maybe three. So, you know, I'm going to be speaking toward 1-2 No Limit, which is, I think, what the majority of normal poker players play, maybe a little bit of 2-5 or 3-6 and 4-8 Limit. I really don't want to say that there's rooms that people should avoid, because every room, even the most serious and best rooms in Las Vegas, like Bellagio, Aria, and Venetian, which I think most people would say are the top three, and Wynn is up there. People would probably say about those rooms is they're going to have the most serious players, yes. But see, what they offer also is game selection, which a lot of small rooms don't offer. And that's because you can go to Venetian and they'll, on an average night, have 19 1-2 games. So you know what? If you hate your first game or your first five games, you still have another 10 to pick from. So I really don't want to say that you should avoid serious destination rooms, because a lot of people like being in a room surrounded by action, which in the small rooms isn't the case. But if I had to personally say, I want to go play 1-2, I want a soft game, where am I going to go? I'm probably most of the time going to head to Mirage. I'm most of the time going to head to Bally's. Or if you want to play just like completely with idiots, you probably should go to Excalibur. but, you know, just... it's Excalibur. But I mean, for the most part, any of the unheard of rooms like Excalibur, or, you know, some of these smaller rooms out there that are on the strip, great drunk action can be found at Bill's. And Bill's will fully admit that we have great drunk action. Those exact it's just because, you know, if you're going to Bill's and playing 50-cent, $1 no limit, you know, you're not there to play serious and put on sunglasses and hoodie. You're there to get drunk as fast as possible and buy in for $40. You can do that at Bill's. But, you know, on the other hand, you go to a room like Bally's. Bally's is constant action. It's one of my favorite places to play 1-2 no limit. They're connected to they're connected right next door to Paris. Paris does not have a poker room. Unfortunately, it closed a few years back. So they have, you know, several thousand hotel rooms all filtering into Bally's. And it's great action. I mean, I've seen a 1-2 table with $12,000 on the table, which, wow, you know, you don't see super often. And I'm not talking during World Series time. I'm talking like Wednesday in November. So it's, you know, it's something that I think that's a great action game. And that's a 300 max with a 100 min. If people don't want to buy in for 100, you can go to Imperial Palace, where the minimum buy-in is $60 in their 1-2 game, and there's some great action there. The Mirage has a 100-300 is their min-max, and there's some great 1-2 there. I played there. Most of my 1-2 playing last year was at the Mirage. I love the staff there and the manager, and it was great action. So if you're looking for 1-2, there's a lot of places you can play. A lot of people play the Venetian's a wonderful room. It's I would argue that it's the best room in Las Vegas as far as amenities and beauty and game selection. So, yeah, maybe they have more they have better players there than other rooms, but they also have 22 games to choose from. And I guarantee you, not every single one of those games has all the best players. It just doesn't happen.
Well, I want to get your take, Michael, too. Last time I was out there, I had a little fun. I stopped at O'Shea's and fell for the whole strip poker sign there. And it's not strip poker, as you would think, but they actually play it outside and cards were flying everywhere. Have you played that before?
Only you can actually play sitting on the sidewalk at the O'Shea's. Yes.
Well, what's your opinion of it? Is it any more than a gimmick there?
You know, O'Shea's is it reminds me a little bit of Bill's, but Bill's moved their poker room away from the street. They moved it in a little bit further in. But, you know, O'Shea's and Bill's kind of cater to the same customer. It's a casual game. O'Shea's used to just spread a spread limit game, and they were like, they were playing a 1-5 spread hold'em. And then they finally, they figured out, you know, we should just do regular no limit. And that's what they're doing now. And, you know, if you're right by the bar, you're going to have a little leprechaun running around outside your table. you know, there's going to be, you know, halfway dressed whistle buy all the time. You don't go there to pay the mortgage. You go there to have some drinks, play some low limit poker, and have fun. I mean, I know some players, some serious 1-2 grinders that go there and actually clean house, because everyone there is usually, honestly, just drunk and out to have a good time. But on the other hand, you have to have patience, because in that type of game, you know, every hand may take 5 minutes because, you know, it's some guy who dropped his cards on the floor or dropped his drink on the table or is too busy staring at the hottie kissing the leprechaun. It's an interesting place. I like O'Shea's. I think it's a fun place to play. I think Bill's is around the same clientele. And, you know, I mean, that's what Vegas offers. Vegas offers Venetian, and it offers Serious Rooms. Then it also offers places like O'Shea's and Bill's where, you know, the goal is to buy in for $100, play all night, and get drunk. And Vegas offers that too. I mean, it really covers every possible aspect that you would want in a poker destination.
Well, unfortunately, this year we won't be out there on a Sunday, but I wanted to talk to you a little about the Imperial Palace Sunday games mix. Have you mixed it up in that a little bit? Because we've played it, and it took us a little while to get adjusted to it, but once we did, it was like free money.
I'm a little bit surprised by that question. You're the second person that's asked me about that game in 24 hours. Here's a little bit of history. I invented that game.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
I was the first person to create that game. I met up with management. That game is the longest running low limit mixed game in town. We started it in March of 2008. And I got together with the poker room manager there, Frank, who's no longer there. He's now managing Bally's and Planet Hollywood. And Jake, who's now the room manager there. Jake was there when we started the game as well. And he's currently the room manager. And he's a great guy. And he runs that game. When we were setting up that game, I had a few friends. I'm a mixed game fanatic. I love low limit mixed games. I think they're fun. And you know, I would rather play that than no limit any day. But I wanted to find a place that would host a low limit mixed game, which originally was being held a lot at Treasure Island, and I had talked to Frank and Jake over at Imperial Palace, and I said, you know what, we'd like to, you know, I have some friends in town, I wanted to play a mixed game, and you know, what would you think we can hold it here? And Jake and Frank were just all over it, and they said, we're going to make you a poster, can you write up a flyer, I'll print out a flyer, can you bring in game cards? And I was like, this is great. And they offered a $3 max rake, which, you know, at the time, in a room that charges a $5 rake in the rest of their games plus a dollar jackpot, for them to offer a $3 rake was just, you know, mind-blowing.
Yeah.
So I took that, and I wrote up a flyer. I advertised it heavily on AVP, and to this day, their cards, their actual mixed game cards that say the name of the game, they actually are AVP cards. They actually say AVP on the back of them, on all of them. So, I wrote up the flyer that's still available in the poker room, and it runs every Sunday night. The original start time was 7 o'clock. I believe that's still the case. And it would run all night. I mean, I played that game every Sunday for over a year. I mean, and my longest session ever playing poker was that game. I think I played that game for close to 30 hours, and then I went home and just fell asleep in the tub. After spending 30 hours in Imperial Palace, you need a detox. But it was great, and it's a 10 game mix. So you'll play games in that mix. You'll never play again. Some of the games, I swear, are borderline made up, but they're fun. Ace to five high low, where it's a five card draw game where there's a high and a low, an eight or better for low. They've been playing Bedusi there before they were playing Bedusi at Bellagio. There's just some of the games are just out. The 3-2-1 Omaha.
Yeah, three
flops, two turns in a river. There's a crazy pineapple ocean. Yeah, we call it ocean crazy pineapple. So you're dealt four cards. You discard on the flop and the turn, and there's a sixth board card called the ocean comes yep. after the river. So you can make a flush if you have none of your suit on the flop. it's a fun game, but you can lose or win. You can lose thousands in that game, or you can win thousands. It's absolute fun. And what makes it crazy is in the stud games, there's a dollar ante, and it's 3-6. So, you know, any serious poker player will go, are you serious? Yeah, it's a dollar ante, and it's a 3-6 game. So it's, you know, the pot's $8 before they deal the first card. And it's a high-action, fun game, and... Yeah, I invented it back in March of 08. I haven't been to it in quite a while because I'm kind of busy on Sunday nights now with the family. But I'm really glad to hear it's still going almost every Sunday. I think it goes 3 out of 4 weeks a month. And during the World Series, I'm be surprised if it doesn't go every night. But I know it's mainly on Sundays.
I still have that flyer, by the way. I mean, I took it home because my parents like to play mixed games when I go visit them on Friday nights. And we always take that thing and whip it out. And I'm like, all right, we're playing 3-2-1 Omaha. And my father rolls his eyes.
You
it's
know,
a great
that
flyer.
Was really kind of written for like just to be used for a couple weeks. They're still using it now, you know, 3 years later. And I feel bad because there's definitely some typos on that.
Yeah, that was one of the things I noticed right away. I was like, huh, I wonder if I could talk to Mandrew and I'll be in their editor, you know?
I wrote it. I wrote it for like just to be used by like people I knew for like a couple weeks. I didn't write it to be used as like, you know, an official thing. And they've been using it for 3 years. And I'm like, oh, well, you know what, whatever. It summarizes everything. I wrote it in like 2 seconds on the computer. But you're not the first person to say that. I've heard a lot of people say, I'm taking this flyer home. I'm going to incorporate this into my home game. And honestly, I find it flattering because that just means that more people are playing things other than what they see on TV. And that's very pleasing to me because I would love to be able to walk into any random poker room and see 4 or 5 different games other than Hold'em running. And to me, that's exciting because that means people are becoming poker players, not just Hold'em players.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you've been in Vegas quite a while, Michael, and you've mentioned a couple changes already. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen in the Vegas poker scene since you've been covering it?
Well, I would probably say the largest single change, obviously, being the poker boom. I've been playing poker since 2001, before the moneymaker effect. And in 2005 alone, I believe 30 poker rooms opened in Las Vegas. God. So you have to realize that prior to 2003, there was at tops 20 rooms that they were spreading poker in Las Vegas. Now, granted, some of those rooms have been around a long time. The Sahara had a poker room. They were the oldest continuously operating poker room in Las Vegas. They had a card room continuously operating since 1956, and they were the only ones that could say that. Granted, about 15 of those years, they were only spreading Pan, but that's still considered. And most of your listeners will say, what the hell is Pan? But that's all right. That's still considered a card game. And, you know, the biggest change has been the number of rooms. The fact that we went from 20 rooms to 58 in basically 7 years, I think is kind of crazy. Other than that, you're seeing the polarization of the destination rooms versus the convenience rooms. I'm noticing that change now, where a room like Aria, Wynn, Bellagio, Venetian, you know, all the serious rooms, the destination rooms, they're getting consistent daily action. But yet, the convenience rooms are really stepping up. I'm noticing this. The convenience rooms are really, really pushing what they have to offer to basically take that business at least somewhat away from some of the bigger rooms by offering comps that are, you know, previously unheard of. I mean, the Treasure Island has been giving away $2 an hour comps since 2006. And, you know, that adds up, and you can use that for any restaurant in the facility. The Aria has recently started. They've been giving away $2 an hour now for about, I think, going on a year now. And they're giving out $2 an hour for, you know, in their poker room. And that's a destination room that's doing that, which, you know, you don't normally see. So you're seeing a lot of that. You're seeing Genesis Bravo, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Genesis gaming system, but it's the poker management software and hardware that they install on the tables. You've seen a dramatic increase in the number of rooms installing Genesis Bravo, the Genesis Bravo system, to compete. I mean, the rooms were at a disadvantage if they were not giving out hourly comps. I mean, Bellagio for years would just do the, you know, wink and a nod, here's a red bird, give me a $15 comp situation. And they did that for years, and I think they still do it to a certain extent. But they also give out dollar an hour comps on their MGO. I don't want to call it MGM Mirage. It's not that anymore. MGM Resort card. Right. So, you know, and they install Genesis Bravo, which everyone was shocked. I mean, Bellagio installing Genesis Bravo, they did. And so did Mirage. Just got it in recently. And Venetian installed it around the same time that Aria did. Wynn has it now. So really, the Genesis Bravo saw a dramatic increase in Las Vegas poker rooms, and a lot of the convenience rooms have had it. MGM's had it since they opened, and that's another change. Other than that, I'm not really seeing. I think the poker boom is very much still alive. A lot of people are trying to say, "Oh, poker's over," and with this internet thing with Black Monday or Black Friday,
both.
I'm not 100% sure what it is, but I mean, with that whole situation happening, they thought, you know, the World Series are going to be lucky if they get, you know, 600 players, and no, that's just not the case. It's like, yes, I realize it severely hurt and crippled a lot of internet poker players. But the reality is that the boom is still continuing. People are still playing poker, and the rooms are still filled during the World Series. So that's great to see. And that's probably the biggest change I see, is that things are still going on and things are really still expanding. A few minor poker rooms have opened and closed here and there, but it's still 58 rooms strong.
Well, Michael, make sure you give your kids a big hug and thank you from us to get you up this early to be on our show today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. The kids are already off to school, so I'm happy to be here. And hey, if I could talk about Las Vegas poker all day, I would. You know, so it's really exciting to see, and I look forward to seeing all of our listeners and readers at the World Series.
Absolutely. Again, that's allvegaspoker.com, the place to be to find out about Vegas poker. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much, guys. You have a good day.
Take care.
This is Daniel Negreanu of FullContactPoker.com. You're listening to Ante Up.
All right, quite a mouthful for this week's Hand of the Week submitter's name, Chris. Okay. You know what that means. Even the very simple names I screw up. So I'm just going to throw caution to the wind and say this hand comes from Chris Marazzi George.
That's not too bad.
Yeah. Oh, well, I have no idea. It's impossible to say right now. Marasti George? It could be. We'll see. But it's a live 1-3 no limit hand played at the Rivers Casino in Pittsburgh.
Nice casino. Been there. Done that.
Very nice. Very nice. And I know our listeners are probably happy that we've gotten off the Badoogie Omaha kick here for a while and got back to crappy no limit hold'em.
Yeah.
For a week.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm glad we're getting all these live hands now. I was worried that we weren't going to be getting hands of the week at all anymore because online, the online situation. So it's good for us to learn how to play live, right?
Yep.
All right, let's see whether we actually know how to play live. All right, again, it was a 1-3 no-limit hand at the Rivers Casino. It says the villain is a Heinz Ward lookalike. I don't know how you know it's a Heinz Ward lookalike in Pittsburgh. It could be Heinz Ward, right?
That's right. Could be.
Was he dancing? he said, so we started out playing as a seemingly competent lag, playing lots of hands fairly aggressively, putting opponents in tough spots. But he has devolved into a maniac now, Chris.
I love that. Devolved.
Devolved. All right. He's bought in for the fourth time. Boy, I wonder if he plays the Monte Carlo.
Man.
buying in full each time. Pre-flop raises have increased from the teens to the 20s to the 40s.
40s?
1-3 game. And he folds maybe 1/4 of the hands pre-flop, raises everything else. He's been getting paid when he has the goods and giving it all back with misplaced aggression.
Okay.
The table in general has been seemingly frustrated by the villain. Our hero here is 3-bet once before the villain arrived and got a fold. Other than that, there hasn't been any 3-betting pre-flop.
Okay.
Wow, what a setup there. Huh. I think we've all played in games like this, haven't we?
Yeah.
You just know it's going to be 20 to go every hand if you want to get in, and you just get frustrated because you can't play. And now 40 to go, and you sit there waiting for that big hand, and then you lose a big hand.
Nothing like making it 15 times the big blind to go pre-flop. Jeez.
All right, our hero says our hero has squiggly 180. And villain is a big blind. Here's a couple. He was setting up a couple hands here. Hero has squiggly 180. Villain is in the big blind. Under the gun straddles a six. Hero sees black 10-10 under the gun plus two. Limps, planning the limp re-raise. The villain makes it 43. Under the gun calls. Hero shoves. Villain calls. Under the gun folds. Villain says, "You're ahead." Board runs out. King 9-5. Ace 9. Hero shows two pair of villain mucks. All right?
Right.
We won one there.
Right.
Against a different player who has also shown a propensity to make what he considered big laydowns against the villain, he has been also seen bluffing later streets. Hero ace jack suited and hijack races to 18 behind a couple of limpers. Villain on the button hems, hauls, and calls. Two players in early position call. Flop comes jack, deuce, tray, rainbow, one spade. Hero bets 65. Miscollect meant 60. Happens live too. Villain hems, hauls, and calls again. Early position folds. The turn is a six of spades. Hero bets 100. Villain shoves the remaining 70. Hero calls and spikes a jack against King King. Woohoo! Wow. All right, so really what we have is just a complete maniac who we have absolutely no idea how he's going to play every single hand.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
A true question mark. A Jim Carrey Riddler. All right, we'll follow you to the hand of the question here. Table stacks. Our hero is in the big blind with 600. The villain is in the cutoff with squiggly 650. Limpers have 200 to 300. Okay. Wow, the villain really is on a roll here.
Yeah.
All right, we are dealt the queen of diamonds, queen of clubs. There were two limpers to the villain in the cutoff who makes it just 13 to go, Chris.
Hmm.
Button and small blind fold, and what do we do with our pocket queens?
I'm definitely raising because whether he's, you know, obviously he's shown what's the word, propensity that he used,
yeah.
to play all kinds of weird crap and to not really have quality starting hands. And I have one. I certainly don't want to just call. If I just call, the limpers will get the right price, and then I'm playing three guys with my two queens, and I don't want that. So I would probably make it 40. If he's making it 13, I'll make it 40. And try to get some folding heads up with this guy, and then anything under a queen comes, and I'm pushing his hand pretty hard.
Yeah. I guess there's two ways to play. I mean, the passive way would be to, at this kind of table, is to play for the set with your queens and give up some the value. The other way is to play the way you play it. I think that's the way I'd play, too. I don't want to give up the value against him. If I can get the two guys out, I might be willing to risk my stack with a good hand like this.
Sure. Plus, the limpers only have 200 or so in front of them, whereas you can literally double through this villain who had 650. So I'm thinking, I don't mind being heads up with a guy who's crazy and who might just put it all in on a draw or whatever and let me get 1,200 out of this hand rather than, 50 or whatever from a limper. So I'm happy to get heads up with this guy.
I'm curious what you think about the villain's raise to 13 with two limpers when apparently he's been on a crazy streak here in raising to 40.
Yeah, he didn't do it every hand. So, that's what makes a true maniac, because you never know what he's going to do. And, maybe he thought in the cutoff 13 would be enough to get him, to get the blinds out or whatever. So I would think, are we out of position? Or are we on the...
He's in the cutoff and we're in the big blind.
Okay, so we're out of position. So he may think that 13's enough to get heads up with somebody or whatever. And I just can't read anything into his actions anymore, given what I've learned from our hero. So I would just say, 13 is just a weird number that he bet, and I'm going to make it 40 and see if he's got the set to call me. So
excellent. All right, well, we go to the flop.
Wait. We go to the flop. Sorry. What happened? I raised to 40, but what did he do?
I'm sorry, our hero raised to 33, so pretty close.
Okay.
Got the two limpers out of the way, and the villain called.
All right, well, essentially, he got what he wanted anyway, which is he wanted to be heads up, so I don't fault the amount of the raise there because it was effective. So that's cool.
All right, now we'll go to the flop.
Okay.
$67 in the pot. We're heads up, out of position. Flop comes 10 of clubs, 8 of spades, 3 of clubs, and I should say we have the queen of diamonds, queen of clubs. So.
Right. Okay, so we're first to act, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I'll bet like 3/4 of the pot or so. Obviously, all unders is a good flop for us. It's a little coordinated in that there's a flush draw and a straight draw for some really random hand. Right. But I'm not afraid of anything here. I don't think he has aces or kings. And if he had 10-10, he might have re-raised me again before the flop. So, he may have, he could have something like a set, but I'm really not going to be worried about that here. So I'll bet 50, I guess, maybe about 50.
I think the really weird thing in this hand is the one thing you want to do with a maniac is not let it turn you into a maniac too much. Right. I mean, there's a case to be made for out-maniacing a maniac. But generally, I don't think you want to be too crazy. But at the same time, the real advantage of being a maniac is you force people to make a lot of really tough decisions in places that shouldn't be tough decisions.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So at this point, I'm worried. I mean, what happens when another club comes? I'm not too worried because I got the queen of clubs here. But, if that 9 comes or something like that, then he's got a big stack. He's going to put me in a tough situation. So I would rather, right now, put him in more of a tough situation than me.
So you're thinking betting more than that?
Yeah, I think at least the pot, and I might even make a case, and I'll see whether I get flamed for this, for betting, even overbetting the pot and just trying to get him to make a mistake right now or shut this hand down or something like that. So I'm not necessarily put to a real tough test with just a pocket pair.
Hmm. Well, I don't know, because the thing is if you overbet this pot and then he comes over the top, are you confident enough that your queens are good, or are you confident enough in your read of this guy who is a maniac that you can let it go when clearly you probably have the best hand, but you don't want to risk 600 on a $60 pot that started? You know what I mean? I don't know. I see what your point is. I feel like a pretty standard play here is if he's a real maniac, he might re-raise 50, my 50 bet, and then I can take it from there. If he makes it 150, do I want to call and see a turn? Do I want to re-raise and shove there? Because I think that he can't have me beat. I don't know. It's a good question, but I feel like a standard play might get this guy to try to bluff at it, at least on the end, if it doesn't improve or get too scary either. I know. I don't know if it happens when a 9 comes and then he bets, but again, we have outs there too. If a nine does come, a jack gives us a win too, probably.
Right, that's true. That's
so
true.
I don't know. I like the standard play here. If say the two the ace of spades was like a two of diamonds and it was really safe, I might consider checking here and letting him try to steal it and then raising him just because you know what I mean, he's a maniac. I might even consider that. So it depends, but that board to me is a little too coordinated for me to just let him get away with a check behind and get a free card on the turn. You know, not that he would or wouldn't bet, I don't know, but really to me, a straight draw and a flush draw right now is just a little too much for me not to bet. And the over bet, I don't know. It's definitely a path to take. I feel like a standard play might be best here. Just my opinion.
Yeah, we're just early in the hand. I'm just trying to think forward. I mean, the real crappy thing is that we're out of position here.
Yeah.
The hand that we think is really strong against you know, his range, and you know, we've got two more tough decisions coming, you know, three if he raises us here, so I would rather kind of cut out those decisions, but you're right, I'm not sure really whether betting more would invite him to make it more complicated for us. All right, well, our hero took your line, Chris, and bets 50. And the villain calls without much hesitation.
Okay, well, it doesn't. If you go to Tells 101, if it was very a very quick call, it could be a draw.
Yeah.
And it depends on the draw, but it could be.
Or making you think he has a draw, and hoping the club comes and can push you off the hand.
Right. So it could be that he's trying to out meta game you by calling quickly and doesn't really have anything, and just waiting for you to show weakness so he can shove. Or it could be, you know, that he has a draw, and if he has a draw, then the turn card. If it's a blank, I'm going to bet pretty big. So either way, I'm probably going to bet pretty big on the turn if it misses those boards, because I'm not afraid of him being ahead of us right now.
Okay. All right, well, go to the turn. We have 167 in the pot. Turn is the four of spades. So our board is 10 of clubs, 8 of spades, 3 of clubs, 4 of spades. So nothing really gets there but a second flush draw now.
Yeah, now I'm going to bet big. I'm probably going to bet 150, 160 here. And just go with the hand. I can't imagine I'm behind here. Really, I can't put him on a set here, and that completes nothing there, that four. So that's big for us. I think you got to bet at least 150 or so, maybe the pot.
Yeah, at this point, you know, we've got lucky. We've got a good flop. We've got a good turn now. I don't want to tempt fate with the river. We got money in there. Let's, I mean, taking out a $167 pot's not a bad thing.
Right.
All right, well, our hero bets 100, and the villain calls fairly quickly again.
Well, again, if he's calling quickly, it just seems like he doesn't have anything. If this guy had, like, top pair, he would have probably raised somewhere along the line. Just calling here, he's letting all these other hands get there for the price that we're setting. That doesn't seem right to me. So it sounds like he's on, or feels like he's on a draw or just floating. And waiting for you to show weakness. So I feel like we're still ahead, and if the river is anything that doesn't complete draws, then I'm going to have to really probably just put it all in.
All right. Well, we go to the river, and there is 367 in the pot now.
Man.
River is the 10 of hearts, so our final board is 10 of clubs, 8 of spades, 3 of clubs, 4 of spades, 10 of hearts. Top pair just got better, if that's what he had. And it reminds us the effective stacks remaining are around 420.
Yeah, I would bet here. I mean, I don't know if I'd shove, but I would make a value bet here. I can't put him on a 10 now either. That makes it less likely he has a 10. First of all, I think he would have defended the 10 a little better heading up to the river. Now that a 10 comes, it's really less likely that he has trips. You know, if he believed that we were ahead when he had a pair of tens, you know, he would have either laid it down or made a raise to find out if he was ahead or not. So he didn't do any of that. I really feel like we're ahead here, and I'm going to bet probably 200.
Yeah, I'm a little conflicted here because part of me says, Maniac, you can't really put them on hands. They just play anything.
Right.
So, I mean, it's really almost a futile exercise to try to figure things out. The other half of me says that part of the genius of being a maniac is you play a lot of hands, so when you hit, people never give you credit for it, so you could punish them. So if it's the latter, I think he would have played this more aggressively, because I think he would have said, hey, I finally hit a hand.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to keep up this crazy man thing going, and hopefully they'll re-raise me, and, you know, I'll make some bank here. So from that perspective, I think the 10 is a very safe card for us. But from the former perspective, I mean, I don't know what to think. So I would rather play a little cautiously with this not being a very strong hand. I mean, it's an overpair to a board. I mean, I'd much rather take a stand with this guy when I've got a set or a flush or something like that.
Well, the thing about it here is that you can't, if you show weakness here and he shoves, what do you do? You're going to call? I would think that I'm still ahead here and I'm going to value bet. If I'm, you know, I'm not saying you learn poker from television, but if you're watching high stakes poker and this hand played down this way, no matter who they're playing against, these guys are betting on the river with queens. There's no doubt about it in my mind on this hand, the way it came down. They're betting this hand on the river, and I am too. I have queens. This guy, I can't. Just because he's a maniac doesn't mean that I got to be scared of him either. Right. I mean, I need to play my hand the way it is here, and I'm playing the way he's played in the past. I'm playing the opponent, and to me, if he had a 10, I think he bets it. If he has an 8, which is probably the case here, he probably has like an 8, like 9-8 or something. And he may think now he's got 8s and 10s, and his hand's good, and you have like ace-king or something. I don't know, but I just feel like we're ahead, and I'm going to bet about 200.
All right. Well, our hero checks, the villain insta-ships, and our hero insta-calls.
Wow. Well, I mean, if I had 200 out there, it'd be a lot easier to call 200 again. But to put 400 out there, that's tough. But I still think we're ahead, but I wouldn't have checked. That's the thing. I really wouldn't have checked here. I would have at least put a defensive bet out there of like 150 or something. That way, if this, when you check, you're showing weakness to me. Mm-hmm. And if I had bet, then the guy's saying, well, he might really have a 10. He's value betting here. I can't get him off this hand, so I fold. But, you know, maybe you think the check is wise because you might, you know, he's going to shove and you're going to get all of his money that way. But really, do you want to take that chance? I would rather just bet 250 or 100. Or, you know.
Well, I mean, I guess it comes down to what you put him on. If you went through the exercise we just did and decided that he doesn't have a 10, and we really don't think he has a set, and we got the best hand here by checking, you're right, it shows weakness. It gives a maniac an opportunity to punish you, as a weaker player would say, oh my God, you just shoved on me, I got to fold.
Yeah.
Instead, you get all of his chips now because you make that call. It's a very interesting decision, I think.
It's tough to miss a bet there, though. That's what I'm saying. If I check, if I know he's going to bet, then I check. But if I don't, then I'm missing a bet with a maniac. You know, if I make a bet and he does have an 8 and he thinks it's good because he thinks that I think that he couldn't have anything there.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, how many maniacs do you – and I'm not lead, it's not a leading question. I'm just curious. How many maniacs have you played at that call on the river?
Yeah. Well –
generally, fold or raise, I would think, right?
Probably, yeah. You're probably right.
You're going to raise a lot on the river because people are going to look at the board and go, gosh, he could have this, he could have that, he could have that. I'm going to fold and not take a chance. Or I'm just going to say, all right, you know what? I trade the crazy thing for 3 bets, and now I'm going to get out of it. I just don't see a lot of calling from maniacs. Unless they got a piece of it, in which case, you know, I mean,
that's what I was saying.
Got an 8, then maybe, yeah. But other than that, there's no real piece on this board.
I just don't want to miss a bet either if he does have that 8. You know what I mean? If I check and he doesn't have anything, he's going to, I don't know, maybe he would shove.
If you bet there, you know, he's either going to raise you or he's going to fold. So you're not missing a, I wouldn't be worried about missing a bet here. What I'm worried about is trying to get as much out of him. And maybe this is the way to do it. Maybe you check in knowing that he just really can't shut down. Or if he shuts down, he wasn't going to pay you off anyhow. And if he does the insta-ship, then you get all his chips. Hmm. I don't think I would have made this move at the time, but now I'm really thinking about it. I'm wondering if that's a good way to play a maniac going forward.
Well, the other thing is I don't know if I would have insta-called if I checked and showed. I mean, it is a lot of money.
Another question, you're right.
You know what I mean? That's a ton of money to take a chance on your read. I mean, yeah, okay, you have to rely on your reads occasionally. But, you know, at this point, I would much rather value bet and see if he shoves over me to make me fold, and then I call rather than just calling. I don't know. Maybe I just play too straightforward with this hand. I don't know. You're right, though. I think you're right. I don't really recall too many maniacs just calling on the end. But if they did have a piece, they would. So if I put this guy on 9-8... I think I would make a value bet, which is what I did going in, thinking he probably has an 8. So I probably would make a value bet, thinking he might call a value bet rather than... Because, again, if he's playing the player, he would think that I think that he doesn't necessarily have anything here, so I could have nothing too. I could have sevens, you know, and he could have 9-8 and have me beat, you know. So thinking that way, I would make a bet here regardless, just because I think he could have a piece of this and he might call and pay me off. And then if he raises, I have definitely the odds to call with my overpair, and then it's a lot easier to call 200 on the end than it is to call full 420, you know, with no information at all on that street. So anyway, I'm dying to know what happens.
All right, our hero insta calls, in the heat of the moment, flips over his queen first.
Well, yeah, that's weird.
Villain studies the hero's hand and the board for a moment, then mucks.
Ah. Oh. So he must have had an 8, right?
Well, there's an epilogue here, so let me read the epilogue and then we can chat a little bit. He said, our hero said he stuck around for 4 or 5 more hands, but frankly, I couldn't focus on anything. I knew that even though I had 1,200 in front of me, the next biggest stack at the table was only squiggly 400, so it wasn't like I was actually playing with 400 big blinds. Still, I just couldn't sit there with all the money. I mean, I had a stack of 25s alone that covered everyone else at the table. I cashed out and talked to the villain as I was leaving the room. I apologized for the semi-hit and run and wished him luck. He shook my hand, smiled, and told me not to worry about it. After a solid 22-ounce Sierra Nevada, the adrenaline and trembling had subsided long enough that I could head out to meet my friend for lunch. I really wish I had waited for him to turn over his hand. At first, I thought he might have Jack-Jack, but in general, when he had the goods, he showed them whether or not people folded. I think he would have shown Jack-Jack in the spot even after he saw he was beat, which means he probably either had air or something like an 8X hand that turned into a bluff.
Yeah.
Says, I think the main takeaway that I got from the hand is that I should have bet more on the turn and probably could have gotten away with a bigger 3-bet pre-flop. I also think the board ran out just about as perfectly for the hero in this hand. If any club, spade, jack, or 6 hits, I think that a lot of the villain's river range that was bluffing becomes value.
Yeah. And that's what it was. I think he was setting it up to wait for the any draw to get there, or wait for you to show any weakness so he could drop the hammer on you. And when you finally showed weakness on the river, he did that, and it just turned out to be didn't really add up. The story really didn't add up, and you know, bravo for that call. It's not an easy call to make, though. You know, I think I would have bet there, but the check induced him to bluff his whole stack off, and you got it all. So your way got paid off a lot more than mine, unless he bet like 100. And then the guy thinks 100's weak, and then he shoves, and then you get the 320 after that, or whatever it is. So I'm happy the way you called there. It's not easy to do, but paid off. And yeah, I can't put him on Jack Jack. I think Jack Jack would have been a re-raise pre-flop, or somewhere along the line, he would have wanted to protect those jacks from an ace king or something like that, or from a draw, and he would have re-raised you or raised you somewhere. So I don't think it's Jack Jack either. I think it's probably 8-9.
Yeah. All right, Chris, I hope I didn't mangle your hand name too much. Congratulations on the big score, and your winning is not complete yet, because we're going to send you a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net. Plug in Maniac there and tell us what you find out.
All right, well, I want to thank Las Vegas Michael. You can follow him on Twitter, at Las Vegas Michael, too. For joining us from allvegaspoker.com. Great resource. Guy knows everything about poker out there, and just glad he could join us. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
All right, quite a mouthhole.
Mouthhole. Wow, that's making either that's staying on the show or I'm making it at the end of the show, because I ain't going nowhere, that one. Mouthhole. That's hilarious.